I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
Last night, I was with my good friends, Josh Berger and Alexandra Crapanzano. I said I needed to go and write the introduction for Simon Sharma, today's guest, knowing he had taught them both at Harvard 20 years ago. As good friends do, they did my work for me.
Simon Sharma, I never missed his class, and the other thing that I would never want to miss was I wanted to see what waistcoat and what glasses he would wear, because he was not only brilliant and articulate and taught me about architecture and about art and politics in Europe, but he also taught me how to look good.
I would simply say that Simon was and is an extraordinary storyteller. So we would all sit in his class, and I took British Empire with him, and we would be riveted the way that we would be riveted watching a thriller, a suspense movie, because we would just be hanging on every word.
Art and politics in Europe from 1660 to 1820. He was the best professor at Harvard. And I was gutted when he went to Columbia.
Simon is our most renowned historian. His books on the French Revolution, the Dutch Masters, or most recently, Foreign Bodies, an exploration of pandemics and the health of nations, have changed the way we think. His television series, Civilization, The Story of the Jews and the Power of Art, have reached millions. I know all this about Simon, but I know something else. He is a fantastic cook. There is much to admire and respect and be in awe of Simon, all of which I do. But quite simply, he's my great friend.
Thank you, Ruthie. Well, I feel my work on this earth is done.
Yeah. Really, I think they were so cute because they were there. I guess, when was that? Was it 20 years ago? I think Josh
No,
just
it was
went
longer than that. Because
Harvard
I've been
reunion.
At, I think it more like, probably more like 30, because I moved from Harvard to Columbia in 93. But they're very kind. And
I don't think they're kind, because it's something I've heard over and over again. Mm-hmm. Okay, praise is embarrassing you, so why don't we go straight to the food and right. talk about your cooking. You just made a recipe in the kitchen of the River Cafe, or you helped, or right. you watched, I'm not sure which verb. Would you like to read the recipe for?
Yeah, this is tagliarini with broad beans and pancetta. And I chose it, I think, principally because of the broad beans. One of my two nicknames at school when I was about 12 was Beanie.
What?
And because I was...
Are you very thin?
I obsessively enjoyed all forms of beans. And I really still do. But I think I enjoy broad beans the most.
I love the way they shrivel, don't
yeah,
you? And
you
I love
see
the way
it.
The color is different, that you get
yeah.
that pale green color.
Yeah.
And then you... And
it's a taupe color.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so read this recipe.
Here's the recipe. Shall I read the ingredients
yeah.
first
yes,
as
please.
Well? Okay. So 50 grams butter... 4 TBs, tablespoons olive oil, 1 small trapea onion, finely sliced, 2 garlic cloves, finely sliced, 100 grams of pancetta, matchstick cut into matchsticks, 400 grams, very healthy, of broad beans, 100 milliliters of dry white wine, 250 grams of fine pasta tagliarini, a small bunch of mint and a small bunch of basil, both torn, I think, and 50 grams of pecorino. And yes, what was going on in the kitchen, very beautiful, I helped a bit with. You would just do a very simple, lovely braise of the onion and the garlic for about 5 in the butter and oil together, which is never be afraid of doing that, until soft. And then the pancetta matchsticks go in. So everything is braising together. You don't want, and I was talking to Jess, whom I was cooking, this is not a recipe where you want the pancetta to crisp up. Mm. So you really want a gentle braise.
Hi, I'm Jessica Philby, and I work at the River Cafe. And we're here today making broad bean and pancetta sauce with Simon Sharma. It started with a little bit of chopped onion in the base.
Right.
Which I just kind of melted down, and then I put the pancetta in until that.
Oh, the pancetta's kind of there already. I'm looking
at
it.
It's
like an idiot. I haven't had my coffee, it's too small. So it's a tiny bit of good pancetta.
And then a little bit of garlic.
Okay.
We never use too much garlic.
Okay.
Because we don't want it to overpower anything.
Right. So everything is braising, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Including the pancetta.
A bit of white wine.
So you're not. Yeah, fantastic. So you're not wanting the pancetta to be crispy.
No,
okay,
no,
I get it.
Kind of more
I get it. Yeah, yeah, I get it. Totally.
And then I'm going to add a little bit of pecorino at the end.
Right.
And some fresh basil and mint.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah. And then comes the magic moment of adding the broad beans in their skins and stir to coat. You fling the wine in, and then the gentle braising heat goes down even lower. And everything marries together. You're non-stop stirring, but only for about 5 minutes or so. Again, making sure the beans don't just completely mush up. And then you can actually, we used a freestanding mixer, processor.
Oh, yeah.
The recipe here says, of course, puree. But actually, what we did was sort of bash the beans, really.
So I'm just going to...
Oh, here we are. A stand mixer.
Yeah.
Is wonderful.
Okay. So it sticks to the pasta a bit more as well.
Right. And then we were just making the sauce, so the tagliarini has to, obviously. Tagliarini, like all very fine pasta, you're cooking it, and then almost, I don't know, what do you think, you know, a minute, two minutes. You're really basically taking out almost as soon as the water has come to a boil. Make sure you keep a little, half a cup of the pasta water. It's going to carry on cooking when you're adding it to the sauce. Okay,
thank
Jess,
you.
Fantastic.
So nice to meet you.
See you,
you too.
Yes, yes. You add the pasta to the sauce, not the
always.
Other way around.
Always.
It's supposed to cook in the sauce, exactly.
I think it's most,
you have to persuade people to do that, really.
Because then, you know, that whole idea also, I don't drain pasta. I always, if you have a colander next to you and you just lift, especially if you're in town, you just lift it out over the pot.
Right.
Put it into the colander with a pair of tongs, and then put it into the sauce next to it.
Exactly.
You don't have to do that thing of carrying it over to the sink, draining the pasta, putting it back in the pan. But you're just, and also then you get a bit of the water from the pasta into the sauce, which I always say. I always love the Marcella Hazan when she says, toss, 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 and then toss again.
Yes,
you know? And
that's
I think
very
that
nice.
Also
that's
is that nice. Kind of, you know, that you can't, you can't. Toss pasta enough.
No, that's absolutely right.
I'm interested that you chose a recipe, that the recipe has pancetta in it, and that brings us to our next kind of starting at the very beginning of the Sharma household, so because you did grow up in a kosher home. And so was pancetta, we did an interview with Otto Lenke the other day, and he was telling us that in Tel Aviv there was a man who sold pork under the counter, like in Prohibition. But did you have pancetta
as a child growing up? It's called basar lavon, which means literally white flesh, actually.
Is it?
That's the Hebrew for white flesh. So it's no longer very secretive. No, it's very kosher, strictly kosher.
Tell me about your family.
They were both great storytellers, my mother and father. I had a sister who was, she died, hence was, about 12 years ago now, 13 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't meant to happen particularly. My mother she had a job as secretary to De Havilland Aircraft Corporation executives during the war. And then she was so brilliant, ferociously organizationally brilliant. She became PA, personal assistant to Sir Basil, you know, the head of the whole thing within about 6 months. So come the end of the war, I was born in early 1945, the war was going on. I was a massive inconvenience and would not have happened, I think, had it not been for the fact that where my parents were living, which was near to the De Havilland HQ,
where is
in Nebworth, and De Haviland was in Welwyn Garden City in Hertfordshire. And their next door neighbour was an obstetrician, a rather fancy society obstetrician. I only know this to be true because he confirmed it, wrote me a lovely letter when I became a young don at Cambridge, saying, well, you not only would not have been a don, but you wouldn't have been any, you wouldn't have been around at all had it not for my persuading your mother that it was a good idea to have this baby. So he told her, he said, well, if you decide you should have this baby, and you can have this baby, moreover, in my very fancy clinic in Marylebone in Welbeck Street. And what he did not realise was that Welbeck Street would be the receiver of one of the last V2 rocket raids, but it didn't hit the clinic. It missed me and the clinic. So I was not supposed to happen, courtesy of both my mother and Adolf Hitler. Yeah. You know, nonetheless, actually, I made it through. Yeah. No, not together. Yeah. They weren't in cahoots. So we were fairly strict. My father was...
What did he do?
Well, he wanted to be in the theatre. He was a very theatrical personality. You'll be shocked to discover.
Yeah.
Yes. But it was very sad. He left school at 14, like a lot of Hackney Grammar, a lot of those kids. He was largely, but magnificently self-educated. I mean, we had not all, it's a mistake, actually. I'm going to be really disloyal now. But if you're part of the German Jewish community that had come around time of the Nuremberg Laws or later, your house was full of books. If you're part of an older Ashkenazi community, not quite so much. My father was very unusual in having not only all of Dickens, all of Shakespeare, all of George Eliot, but he had things like, you know, Manzoni's in translation, The Betrothed. He had all of Honoré de Balzac's Comédie Humaine. So, and he would read out loud on Sunday afternoons. So he wanted to be in a theatre.
What generation came from another country?
Well, my father was born in 1901. His father was born in Botchan in Romania. And my father's grandfather was born in Izmir in Ottoman Turkey. So my father, however, his, you know, we went to the theatre a lot. He produced charity shows, which ranged, because he had lots and lots of thespian friends, actors and producers, Ralph Richardson, for example, Tyrone Guthrie. And he produced from, you know, productions of Macbeth to Oklahoma at the Golders Green Hippodrome. So
he did Oklahoma?
Yeah, he did. He did. Okay. So when I was about 8 or 9, I think. So that was really lovely.
Did he cook?
No. My mother was an arduous... I feel guilty, as all Jewish sons do, about slagging off my mum as a cook. She was an enthusiast, and there was something she could do. She was from a different Jewish tradition. She was from Lithuania, pure Ashkenazi. So they were soups she was good at. There was one called Garden of Eden soup, which was based on lamb stock and lamb bones and barley, which was a kind of deep, classic Lithuanian, which was actually very good in the middle of winter, and sometimes white beans as well, butter beans or small white beans. She went into the kitchen, because she, actually what happened to her after the war, she had to abandon her job. I was, you know, there. And she did not really want to be back as what was then called a housewife, really.
Yeah.
One scary moment I will never forget is when my mother, she had these old mincers, you know, that you attach. Some restaurants still have them, actually.
Yeah.
So you clamp them onto a table. Right, exactly. So you get a coarse mince. Mm. And when she was mincing up some beef, she managed to mince the end of one of her fingers off. And so she bled a bit into it. I looked at this with, I must have been like 9 or something, with horror. Oh. And I remember her poking around with the fork trying to find. She did wrap her finger in a bandage, but carried on cooking. And she never really found the bit of finger. And she did produce these clops, you know, the equivalent to a kind of kosher hamburger. And I looked on with absolute horror. My mother said, she was good when she made jokes, which wasn't that often, they were very funny. Mm. And she said, don't tell your father, after all, it's perfectly kosher. Her finger was.
Her finger was kosher.
So I was looking to see if my dad suddenly, you know, was chewing suspiciously, really.
I think it's quite interesting about women who don't have an interest in cooking, you know, that they don't have to, you know, that actually, if she, there were so many other things she might have been interested that perhaps the... But what's interesting, I suppose, is what did you actually then eat? Were mealtimes a pleasure for someone who loves food so much.
Right.
Did you sit down to dinner and just wish that it tasted better, or did you not know?
Yeah, my mother, there was what my sister and I called a Friday night memorial chicken, which was inevitably over-roasted.
Yeah.
And in deference to my father's love affair with garlic, which my mother did not share, there'd be one lonely clove rattling around there somewhere. Yeah. So it was always dried out. That we really wished. Chicken soup made from scratch was actually okay.
Did you sit down to dinner every night as a family?
We did.
She would prepare dinner, your father would come home, and you and your sister when she was old enough to come to the table.
The one thing I wanted before we leave the family kitchen.
No, let's not leave the family kitchen. We can stay there for a
while. The one thing my mother did very well, which was, and it's interesting in English cooking, because famously, fried, not poached gefilte fish, that's a rather horrible graying thing, kosher form of canelled brochet. the first time that Jewish cooking appears that I know of in print is Eliza Acton's book, cookery book, which is, I think, is 1845. Yeah. And there's a little add-on chapter in the second edition on Jewish cooking, which is then slightly fancy Sephardi, Balkan and Turkish cooking, kind of fried fish patties instead, as we'd say, cod cakes or something like that, which she describes as being eaten cold sometimes in the morning, even for breakfast, which we did.
Yeah.
My mother did that very, very well, actually.
Did she? Did they go to take you to restaurants?
Yes. This is the arbitrariness of being kosher. If you're really strictly, strictly super kosher, you would never go to anything except kosher restaurants.
Okay.
That my parents had redefined the Torah and the rules of kosher, saying it's fine providing you don't have bacon or don't have meat, which is absurd, of course.
Yeah.
So we went to places like in, again, the 50s, the Trocadero, which was so grand, and then owned by our mutual wonderful friend Nigella's family, the Salmons.
Yeah.
And that was magnificent. I remember seeing and not quite believing the miracle of peanuts sitting in what I thought was a silver bowl. It was really stainless steel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then you went down, the Savoy Grill was another place.
Were these for special occasion, or would you just your father come home and say, we're going out?
Yes, he would. Yes, the latter. We certainly would go special occasions. Scott's and Simpson's, I think, you know, and the place was sort
quite
of just steaming.
Yeah.
They're quite grand, yes. Well, my dad was extravagant in that way. He was very much like Max Bialystok and the producers.
Yeah.
Flaunt it, baby, flaunt it. He did
tend
to flaunt
theatrical, it. Theatrical, you know.
So, Cloche and tureens and all the ceremoniousness of eating fish, particularly. We were a great Dover Sole family.
Fish.
Exactly.
So eating out and eating at home and eating seemed...
We ate well,
have a
really.
It was a priority. It was a kind of... idea that you ate well in the Shama House.
The family was food. There's no doubt about that. What everyone thought of the food, it was crucial.
Yeah.
And my wife and I have always, I mean, not. I don't want to pat ourselves on the back egregiously, but we taught our children how to cook from the time they were quite young.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good cooks, both of them. And it was always, there were no TV dinners. I mean, I sound so snobby and grand here. And of course, they'd go off, you know, if they had an extra late class at school, they would go off and have a pizza or a hamburger or something. But overwhelmingly, really, that family dinner was crucial because you talked and, you know, even when they were tight-lipped teenagers, still you talked. So.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you left this home of, you know, of food, of sitting right. down at the table, yeah. of your mother cooking, your father with his great character, and you went, did you go straight to university when you went?
Well, I had the second gap year. I had most of a gap year, and I was actually briefly on a kind of slightly broken down cruise ship that went from Marseille to either Alexandria or Haifa. And I would poke around the kitchens there, and sometimes actually even, yeah, mm-hmm. exactly, and just was... you know, massively in awe of these gigantic tureens of stuff that would be served out to all classes of passengers. And then working on kibbutz, you were very close to, too close sometimes to, you know, the way food happened. I worked in the chicken shed on kibbutz, the so-called lul, which was, they weren't battery chickens, but they were sure not free-range chickens either. And my job was to load them onto the trucks going to the slaughterhouse, which was not fun. In case you didn't know, and I expect you did, the way to stop a chicken panicking is to turn it upside down.
And then upside down.
You do, yeah, exactly. Hold it with the legs. So that wasn't great.
But did you seek out, when you were in that year abroad, and apart from being on the kibbutz, would you seek out the food of wherever you were? Is it something that was important to
food.
Her? Street food, yeah.
I loved Arab food, actually. I had a distant relative was a mining engineer in the Negev Desert, and he rattled around in an old Jeep. He was an incredibly romantic, rather raffish, bohemian figure. Well, bohemian isn't quite right, but certainly he belonged to a colourful generation. Mm-hmm. So he was a very romantic figure to me, and he spoke Arabic very well, and we ate a lot of Arab metze, actually, wonderful.
Yeah.
And the year then was 1962, 63, so that was actually, you know, I don't know, maybe it's, you know, the tragic and poisonous enmity that now exists. We didn't necessarily, I mean, maybe we're kidding ourselves, but we didn't feel, I mean, there were so many Arab friends of his, so many Bedouin friends, actually.
Yeah.
So that was something. So long before wonderful Yotam came along and all our friends now, you know, I knew that what was called Israeli food was basically Arab food, mostly.
Yeah.
Or you were stuck with my mother's kitchen, you know, so.
Well, that's
you
what
went
we always,
for...
it's a revelation, isn't it? Now
that,
you know, people talk about, you know, because I grew up Jewish in upstate New York, and my parents' family were Ellis Island immigrants who came and brought the food that they had eaten, and food was very basic, I'd say. My grandmother actually was like a Hungarian pastry maker. She rolled out the dough. She traveled with her rolling pin. And I always tell the story, but she came to see her first grandson in Woodstock, where we lived in the countryside. And my mother said, "Do you want to see your first grandchild?" And she said, "No, let's eat first." You know, and that was that was the kind of the view of food in our family. But when you went, but also Britain was coming
it's like,
out.
You know, all of the famous story, all of Jewish history, can be wrapped into three short sentences. They tried to kill us. They failed. Let's eat.
We are now in Cambridge, right? Was it Cambridge?
Yeah.
And was that really hardcore? Was that 60s?
Well, I was still, I arrived at Christ College of Cambridge in 1963. And I was still kosher, and it was really bizarre because I'd stopped believing in God, really, basically. Yeah. I was certainly at least an agnostic. But somehow I didn't want to... My mother would send food, including cold chicken sometimes. Mm. And so, I didn't want to offend her. So it was totally irrational. And I had a great professor who we used to have a kind of a supper seminar. And he would produce gorgeous kind of oozy grouse and things that everybody else, and I would get a kind of bouncy rubber cheese omelette from the college, and finally one of these terrible omelettes actually broke me. And famously, I've told this story a lot, but it is true, in 1965 I went to see the Ipcress file, Len Dayton, and I said, did you ever know Len Dayton? I would love, we did actually exchange letter. Is he still alive? He is still alive.
No, I don't think he is.
Okay.
But, so but Michael Caine, of course.
Yes, I wrote a piece for The Guardian called Michael Caine Taught Me to Cook.
Yeah.
And I, not only did he write spy novels, one of which became the Ipcress file film, but he wrote so-called cook strips, which were cartoons for men beginning to cook. Yeah. You know, what is parsley and how to dice an onion or mince parsley the proper way. And these were fantastic. And it was when there was a scene where Michael Caine says to his fellow spy, Courtney, I'm going to cook you the best meal you've ever had. And it cuts to her saying, Palmer, that was the best meal I've ever had. Do you always wear your glasses? And he said, yes, Courtney, except in bed.
Yeah.
And she takes the glasses off. I thought, okay, I've got to learn to cook. And I went out and bought my first little battery de cuisine. There was one gas ring at the end of the corridor in the student building at Christ. So I made friends with John Bolton, the college cook, and he'd lent me the oven. And I made myself an omelette, hot butter, you know, and I instantly knew, and it was, you know, Bava was kind of creamy inside. I thought, boy, you are hopeless with almost anything at your hands, but this you instinctively understand and know how to do. You understand timing and heat.
Yeah.
And then you can make people happy by doing it.
Yeah.
And then I was just absolutely off and running.
Hooked. And that continued throughout.
Yeah, I only really cooked for myself or ate out in Cambridge. And then, in tiny spaces when I became a baby Don, I mean, you had just a kitchen the size of a toilet, really, and minute things. And but I was just in love. I bought my first cookery book other than, it was actually Dayton's book of these cook strips. I'm not kidding. It was called Ue le Garlic. Ue le Garlic. And you can still find it.
Yeah.
But the first thing I bought was Elizabeth David's French Provincial Cooking. The first serious thing I made with John Bolton's college oven was the Alsatian onion tart.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth David, of course, was wonderful to read and also incredibly forgiving, or you could say irresponsible about quantities. And then it was also the period of Robert Carrier's cards, which were great if you were a baby cook, basically. They were wonderful.
Yeah.
So there were all sorts of Anne Jane Grigson, Alan Davidson. Yeah. There were everybody...
First Slice Your Cookbook.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, First Slice Arabella Boxer.
Yeah.
Yes, I absolutely had that. And it sort of slightly aggravates me because then the Good Food Guy was in its prime. I was one of those who would be one of those anonymous inspectors, the Good Food Guide. And when people say, oh, English, you know, British food was until the 1980s or something. The 60s and 70s were amazingly brave and adventurous and exhilarating.
As a historian, how do you teach history? How do you look at history? How much do you look at history and food? You know, when I go to a city, the first thing I hit is the market, because it, not because I want to buy something, but because it tells you how do they sell the food, how do they grow it, what's the market like, are people dressed a certain way? And if we read your books and we listen to your lectures, are we learning about, are you thinking about
food? I think very often it can be quite dramatic. For example, one thing that happened, Ancien Régime, pre-revolutionary France, actually, and post-revolution France too, but particularly in 18th century where they were looking at it, divided into a wheat culture and a rye culture.
What's that? What do you mean?
Wheat flour was only for the aristocracy and the haute bourgeoisie. So people tended to eat you know, rye we think of as wonderful right. now, it wasn't so wonderful. And there were certain amounts of wet France where the rye was very susceptible to a kind of rot, which actually produced ergotism, which is a hallucinogenic state that in extreme form, yeah, would not only give you trips you didn't want, but also would actually numb your circulation and cause gangrene. Mm. And there were lots of incredibly serious reports about how terrifying that was. There was an area called the Sologne, S-O-L-O-G-N-E, where this was thought to be a terrible problem for the population. At the other end, of course, you cannot do Dutch history without food, not only because there are paintings, of course, but because this extraordinary kind of compressed population has actually physically, literally engineered a landscape, both for horticulture and for fishing and for pasture. So it's an amazingly, this is the best fed population possibly in the world, but certainly in Europe. And poems are written to strawberries. And only the Dutch would think of having a painter called Adriaan Coote, who specializes in asparagus, paints asparagus. So it's a kind of festival of the stomach, really. Yeah. And I have a whole chapter actually on food and Dutch culture.
I think that could be part two of our series. I think we should do another one because I think a funny story is a friend of mine, his father married a woman who was a vegan. I mean, she was just, and also this is years ago, and he went into the hospital and while he was in the hospital, he had a painting. You can only imagine what the painting was like because it had a lobster in it, but she had the lobster painted out of the painting. While he was in the hospital. I mean, I thought probably any piece of art that actually had a lobster in it might be something that you'd wanted to paint on anyway.
There are great lobster paintings.
Oh, come on. Tell me one good
Willem
lobster
Kalf.
Painting.
Willem Kalf has...
I defy you to show me a good lobster painting.
I will show you one on my phone.
Oh, yeah, we have phone. That doesn't count. That doesn't count.
I will take you to lobster art.
That's your food and art. Yeah, I want to see the asparagus.
At the Rex Museum is the famous Adriaan Coote, which is an incredibly beautiful painting.
Okay, I can be convinced.
And then a lot of the language about, you know, for example, in the 1620s, this was a tough time. The Dutch were up against it militarily. Yeah. It was a very hard economic time. And not only did the paintings become rather monochrome, but also what actually gets shown in still life food paintings are the what's thought of as the food of our fathers. In other words, herring and cheese and bread. And then when they become a little richer, the country is more at peace and richer, then everything glitters with abundance. Yeah. Far more kind of cherries and berries and sides of beef and so on.
And then you see today Ed Richet having a painting saying hot vegetables. Have you seen that painting?
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
no,
was it Ed Richet? And then, of course, all the cakes, you know.
Wayne Thiebaud.
Yeah.
Wonderful
amazing,
painting. Wonderful painting.
Art.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
people either like or don't like my writing, but they will all say it is full of texture, really, of sensuousness, I think. And for example, this last book I've written, which is about sort of, vaccines and so on, much of it is set in India. So I was actually very interested in the hero, who's a kind of traveling vaccinator called Vadim Mahavkin, who comes out of the Ukraine. He travels thousands of miles around India. And he becomes quite a religious Jew. He's not particularly a religious Jew when he starts his career. But I went to his account books, which simply have very detailed the archives in Jerusalem about what he's paying for what. And sure enough, he lists a craving for walnuts and chocolate. He lists actually some of the food that he's eaten. Mm. He eats Brahmin food, Thali. Mm. So that was which I don't write about. I do mention the chocolate and walnuts, where he's surrounded by bubonic plague and cholera and so on. But I suppose actually in some sense, the kind of world I live in as a writer, it's not an extension of cooking or cooking an extension of that, but they are complementary for me, I think. And more important, really, I make friends with shopkeepers in America. It's very important, not just the man who brings fish to the farmer's market is a guy called Ryan, who's a school teacher in the week and a fishmonger on the weekends. And he's very clever and brilliant, and we lark around together. Mm. And he will phone me up and tell me what's really been landed that morning from Long Island Sound. But I've also known the Italian butcher, Vinny, for many, many years. And so, you know, I just go to, the best of the family, I go to supermarkets for paper towels and loo rolls, and I mean, I couldn't do without them, but essentially the shopping part is fine for me. So early in the morning, I mean, I won't say like you, darling, but you know, I am thinking about what I'm going to be cooking in the evening. Minutes,
I drive into work. I think, what would I want to eat for lunch? You know, the River Cafe, we change the menu for every single meal. But a question also I wanted to ask you.
And there are certain staples as well when the family was growing up, one of them is, and they still, my daughter and son, who was a vegetarian, now a lapsed vegetarian, polpettino, sort of Italian meatloaf. Mm-hmm. Incredibly simple, which you have to, everybody out there, cook in a casserole. You don't want to put it in a sheet pan. You want to put it in a casserole with a little wine or even I know vermouth, so it kind of, the actual meatloaf is actually braising with a little sprig of thyme and sage.
I think you should write a cookbook.
The family, we've said this, and the family says, this is ridiculous. We all have our recipes. You have most of them, Dad.
You should.
We have to do that.
I did do
recipes. I was food writer for GQ for a few years. So then I was doing recipes there.
You should write them, Dad. You should.
But also, from you.
I think you should. Definitely think we're looking for the... Do you... One thing I wanted to ask is that when you are writing, what is your eating? Do you eat before when you're writing? Do you sit down and eat a meal, then go and write?
Morning writer, so I have very minimal breakfast, nearly always sheep's yogurt these days, which I love. It can be quite voluptuous, but it's not a big breakfast. I'm a morning writer. I didn't used to be. I used to be more of an evening, late evening, but I think having kids. And lunch is also, but sometimes you just... especially on weekends, really. But I'm probably not a weekend writer anymore. I once was. But if you have a big lunch, you're screwed, basically. Well, your imagination... There's a funny thing, you know this, about writing, is that you write the way you want to write, and then some fairy dust, if you're lucky, suddenly lands on your brain, and the writing does itself. That magic moment when a sentence lies down on the page and the sentence is just right, or at least on second and third go it's just right, that seldom happens after lunch. Revision happens after lunch, and I never write during the evening.
We do want to end. First of all, I want to thank you for coming this morning.
Such a pleasure.
We love having you here. If food is art, if you're going to convince me that food is art, if you're going to convince me that you can have a lobster in a painting, or that you can eat when you want to share with your children, when you want to, you know, express time, have time with your mother or your father, or when you're on a trip or you're in a kibbutz or wherever you are that you want to eat. You also eat sometimes just for comfort.
Yeah.
There's you just need food. For comfort. And yeah. I just, as I ask everyone, as I asked you, Sir Simon Sharma, who's here with me today, lucky me, what would be your, I hope you don't need comfort very much, but if you do need comfort and you want to find it in food, what would you reach for?
I do love this little pasta sauce, which I make. It's so simple. It's tuna and black olives and anchovies. Mm. And sometimes I halve little cherry tomatoes, but sometimes I just use tomato paste. And then the spaghetti or the fettuccine kind of cooks in that. So it's very quick. The children always loved it. I don't know, my baby time was by the sea, really. Mm. So I think there is a deep fishy, and I'm an Aquarius, you know, a watery person. So that always, and a little lemon zest, actually, at the last minute in it. That's fantastically comforting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Simon. It was a great morning.
Thank you, Ruthie.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.